3CR would like to acknowledge the Kulin Nation, true owners, caretakers, and custodians of the land from which we broadcast. 3CR pays respect to elders past and present of the Kulin Nation. We recognize their unceded sovereignty.
This is 3CR Breakfast.
Oh, yeah.
Alternative news, analysis, and current affairs. Monday to Friday, 7 a.m. to 8:30 a.m.
Only double.
Grab your pants.
Good morning, listeners. You are tuned into Thursday Morning Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM. This is Priya, and I'm in the studio with Kate. Good morning.
Good morning, Priya. I'm curious. I have a question for you regarding your cereal this morning.
Yes.
Did we figure out the ratio?
Well, I mean, I think I normally have the ratio figured out, but I think I was ambitious the last time because I was like, I'm almost at the end of the milk, but I can't tell exactly how much. But once it's out, you cannot put it back in. So, you know, I think I'm only at risk if I'm almost at the end of the milk, but I actually have too much and I'm trying to finish the thing. But cereal was great this morning.
Good. But
I always get made fun of because I love cornflakes. And I'm like, I'm kind of like a dog. Like, I see the same thing every day and I'm like, oh my God, this is the best. I can't believe I get to eat this again.
Cornflakes are yummy, yes. I think. I don't understand the criticism.
Sometimes when I go to sleep, just before I go to sleep, I'm like, man, can't wait to get up and eat cornflakes, which I think a lot of people in my life have said sounds nuts to them. But you know what? Nuts to them.
You know what? You could even have it before bed and then when you wake up.
No, no, that would be too indulgent, I think. Well, we have a big show as usual, and we're going to start off with a little conversation about renting. So you want to take it away?
Yeah. So in the lead up to our first interview with Christy Hoskins, yes, Priya and I are going to have a little chat about renting. And then we will speak with Christy, who is a Bendigo renter and housing advocate, who is campaigning to strengthen the rights of... to strengthen the rights of tenants during... routine rental inspections. She's concerned about the growing use of camera technology by some real estate agents and has launched petitions in both the Victorian and federal parliaments calling for stronger protections for renters.
Amazing. And then after that, we are joined by Dr. Josh Pallas, who is the legal director at Climate Defenders Australia, to discuss New South Wales Police's recent move to drop all remaining charges against people arrested at Rising Tide's 2024 People's Blockade Action, where hundreds of people entered Newcastle Harbour to protest the export of coal, out of the world's largest coal port. And Climate Defenders Australia is a legal service that is dedicated to the rights of frontline environmental and climate defenders. And they represented over 100 people at People's Blockade arrestees. And then after that, we're going to listen to a speech made by journalist Wendy Bacon at a Sydney rally held by healthcare workers in solidarity with Palestine at the New South Wales Australian Health Practitioner Regulation Agency, or APRA HQ, on the 26th of July.
Following that, and for our last interview, we will be speaking with Zeng Chin and Kim Chow Evans. Now, Zeng has been a member of the Save Preston Market Action Group for many years and ran as an independent in Darebin City Council's 2024 local elections and campaigned heavily to protect Preston Market from development. Kim Chow Evans is a creative arts therapist and filmmaker with a background in social justice and community work and is currently working on a film, a documentary on the campaign to save Preston Market. So we'll speak with both of those and wonderful people about current protections for the market's future, whether it remains under threat, and ongoing efforts to preserve the much-loved institution.
Amazing. And we will be back to you shortly with our news headlines. Remember, stay tuned. We are with you all the way through to 8:30 in the morning. 3CR would like to thank our sponsors, Earth Greetings, cards that connect, care, and celebrate. Support wildlife and habitat with every purchase. Inspired by nature, giving back to the planet. Learn more at earthgreetings.com.au.
Justice, diversity, community, politics, sport.
Join us every Thursday afternoon at 4 p.m.
No, no, no. We now start at 3:30 for an hour.
For the Sporting Record.
Or check out the Sporting Record podcasts available on Spotify, Apple, 3cr.org, wherever.
Baseball. Basketball.
You're tuned in to Thursday Morning Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM, and these are the news headlines for Thursday, the 13th of August. Victoria's First People's Representative Body, Gelung Warl, has used its treaty powers for the first time to call on the state government to withdraw a bill that would mean incarcerated people can be denied their daily hour of open air due to operational considerations. Victoria's community legal centres have also voiced strong concerns about the Corrections Amendment Bill, which is set to be introduced in the Legislative Assembly this week. The bill was developed in response to a recent Supreme Court judgment, which found that depriving incarcerated people of 1 hour per day in the open air breached both the Corrections Act and the Charter of Human Rights and Responsibilities in Victoria. The bill would also allow practices in breach of the United Nations Standard Minimum Rules for the Treatment of Prisoners, also known as the Mandela Rules. Rather than taking action to change Corrections Victoria's practices following the Supreme Court decision, the government is instead moving to rewrite the law and override the Human Rights Charter. Also in news, hundreds of people marched through NARM's West earlier this week, calling for a moratorium on new artificial intelligence data centers due to concerns about environmental and water impacts. The protests targeted the proposed Perry Melbourne data center and the expansion of NextDC's facility in West Footscray. Meanwhile, in NARM's North, opposition is growing to Zara DC's proposed data center at the former Ford factory site, which communities raise concerns about, about its proximity to homes, schools, and transport infrastructure. The Campbellfield project is being assessed under Victoria's Development Facilitation Program, which places the final decision with the planning minister rather than the local council and removes the community's right to appeal the project. Also in headlines, the Philippines government has revised guidelines for projects affecting Indigenous people that could weaken Indigenous communities' ability to oppose projects affecting their lands. The new rules diminish guidelines for free, prior, and informed consent, restrict timelines for consensus building, and degrade safeguards for ancestral territories. Human Rights Watch and Indigenous advocates say the changes undermine self-determination and remove avenues for redress, and urge the authorities to consult communities and align the guidelines with international human rights standards. And finally, in headlines for today, hundreds of people rallied in Nipaluna, Hobart, earlier this week against the Tasmanian Environmental Protection Authority's decision to renew licenses for 16 salmon farms on the Tasmanian Peninsula for up to 2 years. Alongside serious warnings from scientific experts, protesters raised concerns about the environmental harm of the salmon farms. These farms use 20% of Tasmania's fresh water, rely on tons of antibiotics to treat disease, and release more than 4,800 tons of nitrogen pollution annually. These have been the news headlines for Thursday, the 13th of August, and you're listening to 3CR on 855 AM.
I'm Jeffrey.
I'm Alphonse.
I'm Erwin.
And we are from the Voice of West Papua.
Tuesday, 6:30 until 7:30 p.m.
News and music from West Papua.
You're listening to 3CR 855 AM and you're here with Priya and myself. Now, we are soon to be joined by Christy Hoskins, who is a tenant that has two petitions, one in the state and one in the federal parliament to try and increase protections for renters throughout rental inspections. So, Perry and I wanted to have a little bit of a chat about experiences with rentals and protections. And sort of one of the things that sparked this idea was I was looking into some controversial cameras that are being used now in routine rental inspections. And I looked up one of the ads to see, you know, how it was being advertised, how it was being justified for its use. And it is advertised as, quote, "Creating detailed inspections is one of the largest pain points in property management. Mapping an entire property requires taking photos from all angles. On average, this takes property managers 2 hours per inspection." Now, Priya, I don't know about you, but I have never had a real estate agent spend 2 hours at my place doing a rental inspection. How about yourself?
No, absolutely not. And I think it is, you know, it does seem like incredibly unusual that that is a, you know, that that's framed as a requirement by the real estate agent, because, you know, you would assume that something that comprehensive would be done, you know, either at the conclusion of a tenancy or prior to starting a new tenancy, for example, to demonstrate that the property is adhering to minimum standards. You know, if the idea is to get an accurate layout of the property, you know, surely that is something that should already exist within the blueprints of the property that the landlord owns.
Yeah, and it's actually very interesting that you raise that, because you think about, you know, the inspections that are done beforehand, including perhaps the condition report that's done by real estate agents. And I can think of one instance where I do wish that my real estate agent was more thorough and did take more photos, because they neglected to include anything on their side or version of the condition report, which, you know, in my mind raised a bit of concern, because it felt that if I didn't put anything in, which I did, I was very thorough, but if I didn't, am I liable for anything that is then found and not included in the condition report?
Yeah, I mean, I've found with most of the places that I've moved into, the real estate agent side of the condition report is minimally filled, if anything. Some have been more comprehensive than others, but it is really something that, you know, my partner and I take extremely seriously when we go to move into a new rental property, which we've had to do much more than we would like. But, you know, actually making sure to take the time to comprehensively document the condition of the property, and now, you know, considering that minimum standards are in place, to ensure that it is adhering to those minimum standards and to flag when it's not, is just so important to protect yourself as a renter. It is, you know, if you don't document those things, then any changes, as you said, can reasonably be inferred based on the documentation that exists to have occurred after you commenced the tenancy. So,
And then when you think about this sort of, I guess, within the power dynamics that inform the tenant and property manager or landlord relationships, like, how do you see that playing out?
I mean, it is pretty well known that people are reluctant to raise these concerns, especially within, Melbourne's property market is cooling. What does that mean? Maybe there is a little more flexibility for renters. I don't know if that's played out quite yet. We do have some of the best rental protections in the country, but at the same time, that doesn't negate the fact that there is a massive power imbalance between the person that owns the property that you live in and you as a renter. And so I think, you know, it is really understandable that even if people know what their rights are, and this is a bit of research that I'm doing at the moment, a current project that's going for the next couple of years, just sort of looking at how people navigate the system and, you know, how they raise concerns and how those concerns are addressed. And part of that is also looking at, you know, when and why they raise concerns. You know, in previous research that I've done, folks have talked about how they've been willing to put up with terrible conditions if it's just them, but now that they've had children, they're willing to take the risk of pushing back. But, you know, we should ideally have a system where if there is an issue, everybody should be empowered to raise it to ensure that they have a safe and habitable home. Yeah, but I, you know, the fear of retaliation is real, even though, you know, we've seen protections come in to try and mitigate against that, including, you know, no grounds evictions being abolished. But of course, there are many other ways that the power dynamic plays out.
Mm. And it's very interesting how you noted, I guess, parents were willing to take a little bit more of a risk to guarantee, I guess, better conditions for their kids. But then that's a bit of a, you know, double-edged sword, because that risk could mean not only yourself suffering from the consequences of that, but your children as well. And that's a quite a sad thought.
Yeah. And I mean, it is really, you know, it is really an indictment of the kind of system that we have, where people have to make such a serious consideration about whether they will raise these concerns. I mean, this is not to say that every time somebody raises something, there's retaliatory action, but more that there is a structural power imbalance that does influence people's approach to raising these concerns, especially if you have really struggled in the housing market, if you are on a lower income, if you're, you know, if you're on a, for example, if your primary income comes from Social Security payments and you know that landlords are already biased against renting to somebody who is on a lower income, and you're struggling to secure one of the very few lower cost tenancies that are available in the private market, as much as that can, you know, be said to exist at all, you don't want to rock the boat.
No.
Yeah. I mean, something interesting that I found when I was looking into photography specifically in inspections is, you know, the law, as you'll hear from Christy, is kind of ambiguous about the use of photography. So it's not that photography is prohibited, but it's also not explicitly allowed. And so it is an interesting tension there. But I did look at the Home Visits and Lawful Entry to Rented Properties operational guidelines for public housing in Victoria, and this is updated as of January this year. And they do have a section on documenting property conditions through photography. And they talk about staff responsibilities in that. And underneath that, the section where they're talking about ensuring that photography during property inspections is done in an appropriate and respectful way, staff must adhere to responsibilities, including with respect to the scope of photography. So apparently photos must be limited to areas relevant to the inspection or issue being documented. And it says here, quote, wide angle shots or images that capture personal possessions or information should be avoided unless directly related to health or safety concern, end quote. So it does seem that at least, I mean, you know, remains to be seen how this works in practice, but it seems that in the operational guidelines for public tenant inspections, there is a specific provision around, you know, how staff should approach taking wide angle shots.
And I wonder, you know, if that could filter through to private rentals, but also whether there is a necessity to include within rental agreements that we sign, you know, are we not covered unless that is covered within the rental agreement?
Yeah, and it does, you know, like it's this sort of balance of regulation as well, where you want to assume that people will interpret the legislation that exists in the best faith possible, and to, you know, by default want to ensure that all parties are comfortable with what is happening, that the renter consents to what is happening. But, you know, at the end of the day, this is the tenant's home and it's the landlord's asset. So the approach to how to manage that situation is being viewed through a completely different lens.
Yeah. And I did notice that some of the debate online over this issue, there is, I guess, the real conflict between, like, well, this is the landlord's home. They own it. They have a right to do what they like with it, which to an extent, yes, like they do own it. But at the same time, tenants are paying to access this service. So they have a degree of, you know, rights and I think privacy as well afforded to them. So it's a very interesting topic. And yeah, I really can't wait to speak to Christy about it. Do you have any sort of personal experiences that you can touch on? And
well, I mean, like, what is allowed in terms of photography is kind of weird, right? Like, your belongings and stuff can be photographed for the purpose of advertising a property. And so we were in a very strange situation where I didn't feel really comfortable with this, but also it wasn't illegal, so that I didn't know what to do, where the landlord was selling the property at a place that we lived at and had taken a photo of the living room, you know, with our stuff in it. And there was nothing, you know, nothing sensitive, but also it did feel like a weird violation of privacy, even though it wasn't legally a violation of privacy. And then because the property didn't, like, we moved out because they said that they were going to sell and were conducting tours through the property of people. And we were like, okay, we don't want to live like this. And then the property remained on the market for like over a year. So then our old living room was just like up on this board outside the house for like ages. It was very strange.
That is really strange to think that, you know, your life is sort of continuing to be broadcast to the public for a year.
Yeah. I mean, I was kind of like, well, joke's on you. You lost some good tenants and then we'll see what happens. But yeah, I don't know. It's just a very weird and murky space. And I feel like as we are increasingly seeing folks be long-term renters, being, you know, locked out of the ability to purchase a home, which is the sort of normative trajectory that's expected, you know, noting the fact that for many, many people, that was never going to be achievable in the first place. We're going to have to find a way for rental regulations to keep up with how people actually live.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's an ever-changing landscape, and we hope that legislation keeps up with it.
Yeah. Well, I'm really glad we had this chat.
Yeah. We will be back with you. You are on 3CR 855. Now, that clock says it's 8:13. However, that is a complete lie.
It is 7:22.
It is 7:22, folks.
The Electronic Intifada is Palestine's weapon of mass instruction.
Netanyahu's at the zenith of his genocidal career.
These people committed atrocities.
This is a war on children, essentially.
Tune into Electronic Intifada Radio for interviews, reports, and analysis Thursdays at 7 p.m. on 8:55 a.m., 3CR Digital, and online at 3cr.org.au.
This is starvation. Time is running out.
Women on the Line, a radical intersectional current affairs program.
Making space for the voices of women and gender diverse people.
Featuring in-depth conversations with guests from So Called Australia and beyond.
Ultimately, we're looking to care for country, to continue our culture, to continue our ceremonies, so that our children have a strong sense of self and belonging.
Just because our marginalization intersect where we're both disabled, it doesn't change your white privilege. It doesn't change your straight privilege. It doesn't change your able-bodied privilege.
Sex work, the word itself, has been such a word with a lot of stigma. However, we cannot ignore that there are women out there who are making their livelihood out of this job.
Listen every Monday morning at 8:30 on 3CR Community Radio 855 AM or stream live on 3cr.org.au.
Love podcasts? We've got you. Find Women on the Line via the Community Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Women on the Line, where about?
Feminisms in their multitudes.
First Nations sovereignty.
Land back.
Trans liberation. Poo-poo on the turfs.
Abolition.
Anti-racism.
Sex worker rights.
South liberation.
Disability justice.
Anti-imperialism.
Decolonisation.
An end to borders.
Workers' justice.
And so much more.
Women on the Line, broadcasting on the 3CR airwaves since 1986.
Woo! Woo!
The People's Record is a podcast that looks at race, policing, and public housing. Over 5 episodes, we speak with residents, lawyers, academics, and activists about how policing has evolved and public housing communities are targeted. Listen to us on 3CR in August.
Hello, you're listening to 3CR 855 AM. It is 7:25 and we are now joined by Christy Hoskins, who is a Bendigo renter and housing advocate campaigning to strengthen the rights of tenants during routine rental inspections. Now, she's concerned about the growing use of camera technology by some real estate agents and has launched petitions in both the Victorian and federal parliaments calling for stronger protections for renters. Today, we'll be discussing the increasing use of cameras during rental inspections, what rights tenants currently have, and the changes Christy is pushing for through the petitions. Christy, it is so great to have you on the show. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hi, good morning, Kate. Thank you for having me.
Now, how is your morning so far? I understand are you on the drive to drop the kids off, did you say, to school?
I'm not on the drive yet. I've left them all in bed, so I've got peace and quiet. Yeah. I've dropped them off at 8 a.m.
Beautiful. Well, thank you for making the time for us, as I understand you are busy. I thought that we could get started by talking about the new cameras that are in use. The new tech toy on the block for real estate agents and landlords that involves continuous recording. Now, for listeners out there who may not have come across this technology yet, can you give us a bit of a breakdown on what's now being used by real estate agents for routine rental inspections?
Yeah, sure. So when they come into your house to do the rental inspection, they have a tripod with this tiny little really high-tech camera on top of it, and it takes a sweep of the whole room, everything in there, a 3D look on it. And then, they do that in absolutely every single room, and you can walk through the recording as if it's a map from room to room to room.
Mm. And as a renter yourself, what are your main concerns with the use of these like 360 continuous recording cameras, and what justifications are real estate agents and landlords providing for their use?
So my concern is the data safety. Under corporate security rules, businesses must use secure backups and remote service. But how do we know that these local offices are following them? We see the agents taking their laptops home, using unsecure home networks, and forwarding tenants' files through their private email. I mean, they already send out millions of chaotic, incorrect text messages with wrong inspection dates. And if they can't even get a text message right, how are we meant to make sure that they're looking after a map of our whole cone, of our privacy?
Absolutely. And in terms of privacy as well, do you have any concerns around privacy for tenants as well?
Yes, absolutely. It's for some people, it can be a matter of like physical life and death. We have thousands of people in Australia, you know, who are escaping severe domestic violence and are living somewhere safe now. And if these real estate agents get hacked, those 3D maps reveal the exact layouts, window entries, all the children's information in hiding. It could be really dangerous.
Absolutely, yeah. And it would be very interesting, I guess, to look into what sort of protections, privacy protections, are in existence within real estate agents, because this is, yeah, very, very potentially, it's a very serious topic. I'm just wondering, are you like, what justifications are real estate agents and landlords providing for their use? Like, why do they need these cameras?
Well, it's corporate greed, really. Agencies, they're using these 360-degree cameras as like a selling point to pitch to the landlords, telling them that capturing all the digital maps will protect their property assets. But they're just using our private lives as a marketing tool to win more business. They brag about asset protection, but they can't say how they're protecting the tenants.
Mm. And Priya and I actually just had a conversation prior where we discussed, I guess, one of the ways in which these cameras were advertised, which I'm going to quote here how it was sort of pitched. So start quote, "Creating detailed inspections is one of the largest pain points in property management. Mapping an entire property requires taking photos from all angles, On average, this takes property managers 2 hours per inspections. And we were discussing that we don't think that we've ever had a property manager spend 2 hours doing a rental inspection.
No, I recently just had my inspection where they did the 360 camera, and his pitch to me was that it actually takes less time for them so that they can get around more places, because it just takes less than a minute every single room, and they're meant to be there to inspect for damage or if there's any maintenance issues, which should be a quick walkthrough also, but instead, yeah, they're spending the time taking these videos.
Mm. And is this something tenants have been consulted on? And do we have a right to deny the use of these cameras in the place we call home?
So, it's a massive grey area in the Residential Tenancies Act. The law gives renters clear rights to object to photos for advertising, but it says absolutely nothing about recording during routine inspections. And tenants, you know, at the moment, the rental crisis, it's massive, it's huge, and nobody wants to push back on this because you can get breached and it can, you know, affect your future renting if you have to go somewhere else.
Yeah, it's very ambiguous, and it's concerning to think that, you know, hopefully some legislation can be put in place that is more concrete and can help us, which you are actually pushing for, Christy. So you started a legislative petition of residents against the use of these cameras that has been sponsored by the Greens housing spokesperson Gabrielle De Vietri within the Victorian Parliament. I'm just wondering if you could tell us a bit about what your petition is calling for.
So we're calling to explicitly prohibit continuous video sweeps of occupied properties during the routine inspections, to restrict digital documentation exclusively to high-resolution static photography of just specific identified structural defects or maintenance items, and strictly ban the filming or photography of undamaged personal spaces, furniture or living areas. So if there is a problem, take a close-up picture of it, send it to the owner. Let's get the problem fixed, you know. But, yeah, otherwise, just to completely ban filming or photography of the tenant's home.
Mm. And as I understand it, you're also taking action at a federal level to change Australia's banking laws in relation to rental ledgers and mortgage serviceability. Are you able to tell us a bit more about this?
Well, yeah, so when I started petitioning for the renters' privacy rights, everybody, all the comments I got was, well, why don't you go buy your own home? So I was like, fine, off I'll go. but, yeah, so I went home, emailed the CommBank CEO, actually, and CC'd in media and politicians so I would get a reply. And I got a reply, and no, my rent, I'm paying $620 a week at the moment, which will soon go up to $650 a week. Mm. If I were to buy the house that I wanted, my costs, all costs including insurances and the costs that come along with owning a home, would be $450 a week.
Mm.
Like, I feel like...
It's a big difference. I'm
being, yeah, big difference, and I'm being forced to pay all these high prices, which is costing myself and my family, you know, so much, mm. when we could be living a little bit better of a life with these lower costs.
And that argument of, well, why don't you just go out and buy a house of your own, completely negates the fact that, well, in order to do that, I need to have a deposit. And unfortunately, it's a bit tricky sometimes to save for a deposit if I am having to pay such high prices for rent.
It is very tricky. You know, people spend decades just saving to get a deposit to only then be turned down by the banks. So unless you've got the generational wealth, I guess, it's really hard and costly to be able to save at the moment.
Mm, absolutely. And how has traction been for your petitions and for your campaigns, Christy?
It's been okay. It's getting out there. It's hard because I guess
nobody really knows me, but I've been posting it out there and putting it out there. Currently, well, I've reached the minimum signatures anyway.
Amazing.
I'm at 168 signatures for the rental inspections, and my federal one for the mortgages, that reached the minimum also and is waiting to be presented in Parliament.
Amazing. And I guess, do you have any plans, like next steps moving forward with your campaigns? Is there anything we should keep an eye out for?
Well, yes. I've been talking with the people from Better Renting and have proposed putting this forward in every state and territory in Australia, because as Australians, we all deserve to be protected. So, yeah, we're going to try and roll it out all over Australia.
Such incredible work, Christy, honestly, and will benefit so many people. Now, if listeners were wanting to find your petitions and get involved with your campaign, how could they do so?
Well, I guess the easiest way, instead of typing in a complicated website, would you could just go to my Facebook and search up my name, Christy Hoskins, and I've got it on public, the links to the petitions and some information about what it's all about. So, yeah, they can join me there if they like. It'd be great if people did.
Amazing. And if there are any politicians or any even landlords, listening who may somewhat, who knows, maybe be questioning your campaigns, I'm just wondering, like, what sort of, do you have a message for them and to help them understand, you know, why this is so important?
Well, we want to live together cohesively, you know, and do the right thing. We're not trying to take away the rights from the landlords or the owners. We just want to make sure that it's a safe space. Like, it's not our house, we understand that, but it is our home, and it's where, you know, all of our life goes on. We just want the right to be able to live in peace and safely.
Yeah, and I think that is, you know, not too much to ask.
I don't think so.
Well, Christy, it has been absolutely incredible speaking with you, and the work that you're doing is fantastic, and you should be, yeah, very proud. And we will be sure to provide links to the petitions and your Facebook page within our show notes for listeners if they want to get involved.
Thank you so much, Kate.
All right. We will catch up again. Hopefully, Christy, you can keep us updated on this, and we'll speak with you soon.
Yes, absolutely. I will. All right. Thank you, Kate.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye.
And that was Christy Hoskins, a Bendigo renter and housing advocate campaigning to strengthen the rights of tenants during routine rental inspections. She's lodged a petition with the Victorian Parliament and the Federal Parliament calling for stronger protection for renters. And if anyone is interested in checking those petitions out and Christy's campaign, we will put some links up in our show notes at the end of the show.
Women on the Line, a radical intersectional current affairs program.
Making space for the voices of women and gender diverse people.
Featuring in-depth conversations with guests from SoCord Australia and beyond.
Ultimately, we're looking to care for country, to continue our culture, to continue our ceremonies, so that our children have a strong sense of self and belonging.
Just because our marginalisation intersect where we're both disabled, it doesn't change your white privilege. It doesn't change your street privilege. It doesn't change your able-bodied privilege.
Sex work, the word itself, has been such a word with a lot of stigma. However, we cannot ignore that there are women out there who are making their livelihood out of this job.
Listen every Monday morning at 8:30 on 3CR Community Radio, 855 AM, or stream live on 3cr.org.au.
Love podcasts? We've got you. Find Women on the Line via the Community Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Women on the Line, we're about
feminisms in their multitudes.
First Nations sovereignty.
Land Back,
Trans Liberation, Poo Poo on the Turfs,
Abolition,
Anti-Racism,
Sex Worker Rights,
South Liberation,
Disability Justice,
Anti-Imperialism,
Decolonisation,
and End to Borders,
Workers' Justice,
and so much more.
Women on the Line, broadcasting on the 3CR airwaves since 1986.
Woo! Woo! Woo!
Have you heard it on the news about this fascist group thing? Evil men with racist views spreading all across the land.
They're pulling on the boots in Brazil and wiping off the eggshells in Moorabbin. Fascism's on the march, and we say, yeah, nah.
Yena Pasaran is a new weekly program on 3CR dedicated to tracking this rise in Australia, Aotearoa, and all around our increasingly warm little globe.
Every Thursday at 4:30 p.m, we'll be talking to writers and fighters about some angry blighters.
Brothers, sisters, we don't need that fascist group thing.
Every day, people in prisons across Australia are subjected to strip searching. It is an unnecessary, degrading, and deeply harmful practice that must end. It involves a person literally being stripped of their dignity, forced to remove their clothing for their bodies to be inspected by prison guards, being forced to submit to humiliating requests like bending, squatting, and spreading their legs. In many prisons, people are subjected to this repeatedly and routinely. Children as young as 10 years old are being forced to remove their clothes and have their bodies inspected by adults. We're calling on the federal government to stop state-sanctioned violence by ending the routine, unregulated use of strip searching in prisons across Australia. Go to endstripsearching.com. Together, we can demand a system that upholds dignity, safety, and human rights. Fig Jam is a 3CR supporter.
Don't have $1 million and still want to have a good education for your kid? Tune into the Dogs program. We are the defenders of government schools. 12 p.m. on Saturdays here on 3CR. 855 on the AM dial podcast. Streaming live on 3cr.org.au and 3CR digital. We defend government schools because they need it.
You are tuned into Thursday Morning Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM, and it is 7:42 in the morning. And we are now joined by Dr. Josh Pallas, Legal Director at Climate Defenders Australia, to discuss New South Wales Police's recent move to drop all remaining charges against people who were arrested at Rising Tide's 2024 People's Blockade Action, where hundreds of folks entered Newcastle Harbour to protest the export of coal out of the world's largest coal port. Climate Defenders Australia, a legal service dedicated to the rights of frontline environmental and climate defenders, represented over 100 People's Blockade arrestees and had repeatedly petitioned for the withdrawal of their anti-protest charges after New South Wales Police's failure to prosecute a set of test cases. Good morning, Josh. Thank you very much for joining us.
Good morning. Thanks for having me on.
Of course. Now, to give listeners a bit of context, the 2024 People's Blockade was a sort of 10-day action in Moolabinba, Newcastle, on Ngunnawal and Ngambri country in Canberra as well. And it was a combined action by Rising Tide, but the Moolabinba, Newcastle action was something that involved people that entered the water at Newcastle Port to conduct a people's blockade, blocking the shipping channel of Newcastle's coal port, which is the largest in the world. And it is the 13th flotilla blockade that has occurred of the Newcastle coal port at that time. And they forced a coal ship to turn around. And 170 people, I believe, were arrested for blocking that shipping channel on the day. So that's a bit of background. But I wanted to ask you now, over the past few years, we have been seeing an increasing escalation in crackdowns on climate and anti-genocide protesters across the country. And 3CR has been following New South Wales' increasingly draconian crackdown since the backlash against Blockade Australia's Port Botany action, and that was in March of 2022. Now, keeping in mind the nature of the action that Rising Tides People Blockade took. Can you tell us about the offences that people arrested at the People's Blockade were charged with by New South Wales Police?
Yeah, so almost all of the people were charged with two offences. One of them was for causing a serious obstruction or disruption to the Port of Newcastle. It's funny that you mentioned Blockade Australia. After the Blockade Australia actions in 2022, Dominic Perrottet's government introduced this new offence. So that's this offence of serious obstruction or serious disruption to a port. And that carried a maximum penalty of 2 years jail or a $22,000 fine. So almost everyone received that charge. And also another charge, which was called operating a vessel to unreasonably interfere with others' use of the Port of Newcastle. And that's a fine-only offence, and that carried a maximum penalty of $5,500.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, like, these penalties are still, you know, quite serious, and seeking to apply them at such a scale, I'm sure, was also intended to send a bit of a message. Now, there has been a pretty long and arduous process for the arrestees of attempting to get the charges dismissed. Can you talk about the series of test cases that were taken to hearings and about New South Wales police's attempts to pursue prosecution?
Yeah, sure. So as you said in the intro, these people were charged in October 2024, and I'm talking to you in August 2026, and the charges have only just been dropped. So the first step was a test case was run by a lawyer called Cassandra Bennett from Byron Legal. She represented everyone from the Northern Rivers who attended the People's Blockade, and so she went first. And her clients entered a plea of guilty to the fine-only offence, but a plea of not guilty to the really serious offence that carried jail time. A decision was made by all the lawyers at the time that she would go first. And everybody thought that an agreement had been reached that, like, the outcome would be universalised across all of the clients. So, you know, if the protesters lost, people might change the way that they plead, but also if police lost, they might withdraw the big anti-protest charge. So anyway, that hearing went ahead in October last year, and Cass won. So the court found that there was no case to answer on the 2 years imprisonment charge and threw it out and awarded $73,000 of costs against police. So we thought, great, now's our chance. Let's get the charges withdrawn. And us and the other lawyers involved started writing to the police asking for them to withdraw charges. Mm-hmm. But when, like, the next procedural hearing came along early this year, police said that they were going to press on with all of the charges against everybody. So we then got a second test case listed in June. Now, some of my clients were a bit different to Cass's clients. They wanted to plead not guilty, to both charges. And so we had three clients who were going to court in June of this year to run a second test case, saying they were not guilty to both charges. The week before the hearing, the police offered to drop the really serious charge if our clients entered a plea of guilty to the less serious charge. One accepted that offer. And then on the day of court, police dropped both charges against one of our clients. And so we ended up with only one client left in our June test case. Mm. And we challenged that $5,500 fine offence, and we also won. Mm-hmm. And now costs are reserved in that case. But then we started writing to police again saying, hey, look, now you've lost twice. Please withdraw the charges. And there was already going to be a procedural hearing last Friday. So they confirmed that they were dropping all the charges only a day or so before then, and the charges were then dropped.
Yeah, I mean, it does seem like quite a torturous process for the arrestees and for yourselves to have to, you know, keep demonstrating that this is not going to be a successful prosecution, that it's not valid, the charges should be dropped, and to keep, you know, attempting to press that point. And I just want to ask, you know, how has this drawn out process and its conclusion affected arrestees?
Yeah, that's a great question. Like, I appreciate you saying that it's an impost on us as well. I mean, we're just doing our jobs as the lawyers, right? It's the activists who are at the pains of the criminal justice system who are the ones that really cop it. So a lot of them have been understandably really stressed and quite anxious about the whole drawn-out process, you know, especially because some cases were succeeding and there was seemingly no rationality to police's decision to continue in circumstances where courts had already found there was no case to answer. So there's that stress and anxiety around it being kind of just a really unknown process, really unfamiliar, but also seemingly kind of irrational. And then, you know, there are actual real world consequences to facing charges. You know, some of our clients come from regulated industries. I'm not saying they're lawyers, but similar to law, you know, like if I was charged with an offence, I'd have to disclose that to the Law Society. If you're a medical professional, you've got to disclose that you've been charged with an offence to your professional regulator. Some employers require disclosure. Some people have had to cancel, you know, work-related travel and things like that because of the uncertainty of the hearing dates and needing to come to court for certain hearing dates. Other people have had kind of their care responsibilities or medical treatments disrupted because they've had to come to court for hearings and things like that. So, you know, like people think of the criminal justice system as meting out penalties at the end, but really in many respects, part of the penalty, part of the deterrent effect is the whole process. And it's extraordinary, isn't it? Because all our clients were trying to do was call for stronger climate action to protect people and planet for all of us in the future. You know, it's hardly a radical act.
Yeah. I mean, you know, something else that I'm interested in this sort of protest policing space is, you know, the imposition of particular conditions on protesters that might prevent them from engaging in any further action while, you know, prosecution is still being sought. Was that at play at all in this case?
That's a good question. We came into these matters a bit late in the piece, so a lot of the bail conditions had fallen away, but like we have over 100 rising tide cases from 2025, and all we do is activist work. And, you know, I've been doing this work for almost a decade now and seeing bail conditions that stop people from speaking to other activists and stop people from engaging in otherwise legal protests is on the rise across the country, not just in New South Wales, but in Victoria, where you are, in WA, in Tasmania, like we're seeing it rise across the board. And it's definitely having a chilling effect. But, you know, this is why it's so important that people get specialist representation and legal advice. And we push back on all of this because protest has been core to our democratic system of, you know, government for forever. So we need to defend it.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you for taking us through that. And I wanted to just wrap up by asking what lessons you think can be drawn from this case for the environmental justice space going forward. And are there any developments that you're keeping an eye on in New South Wales or other jurisdictions that may be consequential for direct actions like the ones we've discussed?
Yeah, so, I mean, I guess the lesson is that if you want to fight, you should fight for your right to protest. And there are lawyers around who can help you, you know. So if you've been arrested at climate or environment protest, if you need advice, if you don't know what to do, contact us. Like, we're here to help. That's our one job. It shows that sometimes when you do fight, you win. It's not always a losing narrative for climate and environment protesters. And I hope that activists listening in feel power from that. In terms of law reform around the country, like at the moment, WA is the most scary jurisdiction. There are 3 anti-protest bills before Parliament over there, one extending post and boast rules, one trying to effectively put in place a permit system for protests, and a really new regressive regime that clamps down on land forces protests. Because land forces is going to be over in WA this year, not in not down where you are in Victoria. And they're incredibly draconian measures in those bills. So we've been working with activists in WA to see how we can push back against the legality of those bills if they happen to pass Parliament, but fingers crossed they don't pass. On the flip side, in New South Wales, they're considering a Human Rights Act, which might enshrine a right to protest. Will that make a huge difference? Who knows? But, you know, it's a baby step to even just have a line in the law saying you have the right to protest, isn't it? So that's a glimmer of hope.
Yes. I mean, you know, people are going to continue to take action as well. And all we can hope is that, you know, the tide will turn and there will be a recognition of the fact that these are actions that are protective of our future rather than protective of the status quo. So hopefully we'll see some positive change on the horizon. In the meantime, I guess people can just make sure that they are, you know, very much across their own rights as protesters, across the relevant legislation in their areas, and, you know, just make sure that they have a concrete appraisal of any risks that they might be taking.
Absolutely. And, you know, not be deterred, not be chilled.
Yes.
Right to protest is important. Climate action is needed now. So let's make it happen.
Yes. Well, thank you so much, Josh. I really appreciate you making the time. And this was, I think, a very important discussion and a heartening one as well.
Thanks so much.
Thank you. And that was Dr. Josh Pallas, Legal Director at Climate Defenders Australia, who spoke with us about New South Wales Police's recent move to drop all remaining charges against people arrested at Rising Tide's 2024 People's Blockade Action, where hundreds of people entered Newcastle Harbour to protest the export of coal out of the world's largest coal port. It is 7:56 in the morning, and you are listening to Thursday Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM.
Into the Fold explores what happens when disabled people in the media get together to devise and run our own professional development infrastructure. Building community, getting stuck into the nuts and bolts of the training and broadcast sectors, and how we entwine radio careers in the course of our lives. Plus, you'll get to discover your new favourite tunes from performers and composers who are living with disability while honing their craft across the idioms of sensual R&B, vibrant jazz, frothy country pop, and more. Catch Into the Fold here on 3CR from the 17th of August. Monday mornings at 10:30.
You are on 3CR 855 AM, and now we hear from a speech made by journalist Wendy Bacon at a Sydney rally held by healthcare workers in solidarity with Palestine at the New South Wales Australian Health Practitioner Regulation Agency HQ on 26th of July 2026. In the speech, Wendy speaks about never forgetting to foreground Palestine, even though the fallout for civil liberties can be very confronting. Before speaking about the actions of Dr. Peter McDonald, an eminent cardiologist who was suspended because of alleged anti-Semitism remarks he made about Israeli intelligence agency Mossad. Now, Vivian Langford of 3CR's Climate Action Show recorded the piece and also provides a brief introduction.
This is Vivian Langford reporting from George Street in Sydney for Community Radio 3CR. I'm outside APRA, which regulates and registers health professionals all over Australia. On the steps stand four nurses with a Palestinian flag and a large banner saying, "Dr. Hussam, set him free." This is about Dr. Hussam Abu Safia, who has been imprisoned without charge in Israel for 18 months and whose health is deteriorating very fast. Listeners, you might remember him back in 2024. There was a siege on the hospital, Kemal Adwan Hospital, where he was a paediatrician, neonatologist, and his son, 15-year-old son, was killed just before the hospital was evacuated and the Israeli soldiers took him hostage, took the doctor hostage. So you can see why nurses can identify with the plight of their colleagues in Gaza. A large group of people carry banners about genocide, and the reason we are here is because health workers are increasingly worried that they can be deregistered or face discipline from APRA. The Australian Nursing and Midwifery Association is the largest union in the country, and they are concerned that the recent adoption of the IHRA definition of anti-Semitism will cause unnecessary harm. They condemn anti-Semitism and all forms of racism, but this definition may conflate legitimate criticism of Israel with anti-Semitism. It's confusing people and making nurses and midwives worry very much. Health workers could face regulatory action for valid criticism of the genocide in Israel.
Next up, I'd like to introduce Wendy Bacon. So I know Wendy, yes, she doesn't really need much of an introduction, but Wendy doesn't know me, but I know her from maybe 15 years ago when I was a student at UTS setting up Students for Palestine. And I remember hearing Wendy speak quite a few times. She is a professor of journalism at UTS, and she's an activist journalist and long-time supporter of the BDS movement. She is now a reporter for Michael West Media, and most recently she's been reporting on the impact of the pro-Israel lobby on the on Australian health and politics. Thanks, Wendy. Can you hear me? Yeah, okay. Close, yeah. First of all, thank you very much for inviting me to speak today. I'd like to acknowledge the Gadigal people whose land we stand on. This land was never ceded. And let us not ever forget the terrible and tragic gap in the healthcare outcomes for First Nations people in this country. I'm here today to support every healthcare worker around Australia, from Cairns to Perth to Broome to Darwin, that is standing up against this destructive decision by APRA. And I'd also like to mention, because it was very significant, I think, to hear about the Tamil genocide today, because I am old enough, and I guess I've been active long enough, to remember those terrible days of the last stand of the Tamil Tigers. And I was personally in a room at UTS when a person I knew there was receiving calls from people, literally them being killed. So, you know, we are part of a broader movement, but right now we're here to support and oppose the Medicide in Palestine. It's the ethical duty of healthcare workers, as has been explained, and I support everything that's been said by others about the situation. It's the ethical duty to stand up for human rights, for truth, and for proper healthcare system, for healthcare for every human being. There is a Medicide happening where 1,400 healthcare workers, and I think it's more than that now, have been killed in Gaza alone. And we all have a stake in this. I'm not a healthcare worker, but I am a patient, and every single one of us has a stake in this. Because, as has already been explained, if you get a complaint against you, as happened once to me as an academic at UTS, it is so stressful that has already been said. You cannot speak about it. You have to internalise it. And that is the real danger of this. I don't think it's necessarily just the danger of nurses and doctors and dentists losing their accreditation, losing their jobs. It's the chilling effect. It's the feeling that you cannot put something on your own social media about a genocide because you may get to work and suddenly find you're not welcome there, that you have to deal with something secretly. So the implications of this are huge, actually, for hundreds of thousands of healthcare workers. Now, I'm here, of course, as a journalist as well. And as a journalist, we have an ethical duty to speak up about matters of public interest. And if a genocide and a medicide is not a matter of public interest, well, then nothing is. And yet, why don't the majority of people in Australia right now have any idea about this decision, even what APRA is or what it stands for? And the reason they don't know is because the media fails in its task of explaining. Now, We have had some good news articles, and they're very good to see, but there's so much more that needs to be done if you're going to explain a decision like this. I do now report for independent media, and Michael West... but Michael West is one of a number of independent media. There's Deep Cut, there's The Shot, you know, I'm not going to name them all. And there's also the left-wing media that do carry a lot of valuable information as well. And part of all our tasks have to be every day to try to break through the information barriers and to spread the word. And I know you're all doing that. So I became involved in reporting on the, I guess, the Zionist lobby, if you like, and I've done this work with two Jewish Australians, Yaakov Aharon and Kathy Peters, and with a young a young investigative journalist called Stephanie Tran, who is brave and is half a century younger than me. Now, this, just quickly, there's four aspects I'd like to focus on of the work. And I encourage you, because there's a lot of information in it and we cut lots of information as it is. The first thing is we never must stop focusing on the meta side itself. We never must stop focusing on the crimes and become so involved in our local struggle that we fail to foreground that. And I won't go further into that. The second thing I'd like, a person I'd like to mention is a cardiologist called Peter McDonald. Yeah. Now, Peter McDonald is a very well-known and leading medical professional in Australia. If he can be silenced, well, try being a nurse at Cairns Hospital. You know, what chance would you have? Now, what Peter McDonald did was make a cynical comment, a question about Mossad possibly being connected with some undercover actions. And at the time I was on the panel and commented that if you can't speak about intelligence agencies in a realistic and cynical way, well, I don't know what you can speak about. I've been speaking about them all my life. So Peter, first of all, it went to Tel Aviv, an influencer there, into the far-right media in Australia, into The Australian. Next thing, St Vincent's Hospital and Victor Chang Research Institute put these outrageously defamatory statements on their website, calling him a racist and a bigot, and that was all he's done. And next thing, so that happens. Now, how could the lawyers not advise him not to put those statements up? Next thing, Peter can't go to work for, I think it was 9 and then 11 weeks from Victor Chang. Now, that was enough. And they removed, after getting a letter, they removed the statements, and Peter's been back at work doing his valuable heart research. Next thing, he's invited to give a lecture at Melbourne University in St Vincent's Hospital, and he gets a letter disinviting him after 5 weeks, but on the grounds of unnamed individuals putting pressure on the decision makers on behalf of other unnamed people who we don't even know. And none of them. Now, thanks to the work of activists, I think 10,000 letters have been sent out. The lecture time is past. 10,000 letters were sent out. And but Melbourne University started blocking them. So Melbourne University doesn't want to hear from people about its unjust and unexplained decisions. So Peter is an example, and he's continuing working, but Peter is an example of why we must, of course, oppose this decision. And then the next thing I'd like to mention is, while we've been protesting about genocide, our state governments have been building links with the Israeli healthcare system. And the memorandum of understanding between the New South Wales government and Sheba Hospital, the biggest hospital in Israel, must be cancelled. New South Wales has not taken a lot of steps to implement that memorandum of understanding, but in Victoria, we've got a Labor Premier who got up recently at an event and said she wanted to build stronger links with the Israeli medical system. Now, you know, international medical bodies are now calling for the, and have been calling many of them for a long time, for the Israeli Medical Association, of which our own Jewish Medical Federation is associated, to be disconnected from the World Medical Association. It is unethical and appalling of Jacinda Allen to be making those sort of decisions. Now, the last thing, and this will, I'll finish on this, is we need to, as journalists, examine how decisions are made. And I will not be told I'm anti-Semitic, because, which I have been, but I won't be taken on board and be told I'm anti-Semitic because I want to know how APRA came to make this stupid decision. Steffi and I sent in questions to APRA the week before last. They were quite detailed, and all we got back is no answers. We want to know things like what meetings they'd had, had the board approved it, other basic bits of information. And what happened is we got back a statement. That statement is very similar to the one that's been sent to healthcare workers and all many people who've signed statements. It's a signed same statement. And there's just one thing I'd like to say about it. APRA agrees that they were not going to adopt the IRA definition until they read Gillian Siegel's handbook. And suddenly there was clarity. Now that could not be, I mean, that is said, that statement, to somehow mollify healthcare workers and make them feel it's all going to be fine. But you only have to look at that healthcare, that Gillian Siegel handbook on anti-Semitism, to huge alarm bells are ringing. For example, you cannot say Israel is committing a genocide if you have not somehow said it about other countries. I mean, this bullshit, and it is bullshit, about you can't speak, you can't apply a standard to Israel that you're not applying to other people, is just a charade. It actually doesn't mean anything in practice. And there's other things too, like it's an absolute danger, the IRA definition, to the whole notion of a peaceful boycott. Peaceful boycotts are something that I imagine most people here support. I supported one in South Africa. I will continue always. I supported one for the Gurindji and land rights. Peaceful boycotts are part of social change and are absolutely appropriate action when you feel you can't support something. So look, I want to join the others in just saying this will not be the end, COPRA. As journalists, we will continue to report. Healthcare workers will continue to stand up and will insist on answers and meetings, and the public will just more and more come up.
You're listening to Thursday Morning Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM, and we just heard a speech made by journalist Wendy Bacon at a Sydney rally held by healthcare workers in solidarity with Palestine at the New South Wales Australian Health Practitioner Regulation Agency, or APRA HQ, on the 26th of July 2026. And it was introduced by Vivian Langford of 3CR's Climate Action Show, and she also recorded the piece and provided a bit of context around what was happening. And remember, you can catch the Climate Action Show on Mondays from 5 to 6 p.m. on 3CR 855 AM.
And now we are joined by Zeng Chin and Kim Chow Evans to speak about some updates with the Save Preston Market campaign. So Zeng is a community organiser and has written a PhD in urban planning about the Preston Market and how the group managed to save it from development. And Kim is a filmmaker with a background in social justice and community work. She's currently filming a documentary about the Save the Preston Market campaign. Thank you so much for being in the studio with us.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
So I thought we could start, Zeng. I'm just wondering, the Save the Preston Market campaign has been fighting for years to protect the historic Preston Market against demolition and development. What's the latest the community has heard about the status of the markets?
So as far as we know, things are good. So it's kind of pitchforks down, we can take a rest. We'll talk a bit about this as well, but the heritage overlay essentially protects the market from redevelopment. So it is protected as far as I know. There's always a bit of grey, especially in planning, but I think based on the actions of the previous owner, Salter, the previous majority owner, Salter, and them selling the majority of their share to Medich, it's a sign that they've given up the fight to push for redevelopment of Preston Market because it is protected. So I think as community members, we're pretty tired. And so we're glad that it's kind of at this point. But I think we'll always be on guard.
Mm, absolutely. And was there anything that you wanted to add to that, Kim?
I think that there's signs that the market is, that the developer now wants to promote the market. There's more stalls opening up now. There's more advertising now for new stall holders. And also there's advertising around a new era of the Preston Market. Mm. But obviously we're still going to wait and see as well, because we don't know what's going to happen in the future.
Mm. Yeah.
I have noticed...
Oh, I was just going to weigh in on that as well. As somebody who goes to the Preston Market all the time, it has been interesting to see this sort of uptick in stall holding and events happening at the market, especially on the weekends. So, that's very interesting background.
Mm. Mm. Yeah, I've noticed that too. It's really exciting to see new shops popping up. And the market was rezoned to include a heritage overlay in August 2023 after sustained effort by the Preston community through the Save Preston Market campaign. Now, at the same time, the Victorian Minister for Planning was made the responsible authority for development of the markets in amendments made to the Darabin Planning Scheme. However, the land is still privately owned, as you said, by Medich, fully owned by Medich now.
There's small pockets that are not owned by Medich.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Okay. Good information to know. So in the past, the Minister has directed the Victorian Planning Authority to review planning controls for the market in the same year it released the Plan Melbourne 2017 to 2050, which identified the markets as an ideal location for future development of housing and infrastructure. So how extensive is the protection awarded by the 2023 Heritage Overlay? And could the market still be under threat despite this protection?
So the protection, if you look at the technical documents, it says that a substantial amount of the market needs to be remained. So the thing with planning, it can be quite grey, and they use these terms because it allows for a bit of this or that, which is sometimes good and sometimes bad. But basically, it's like the market is protected. The footprint of the market is pretty much protected. There can still be development around, and in the planning amendment, they do talk about the potential to develop up to 1,200 dwellings. Mm-hmm. So if you go back to the original plans that Darabin put forward in counter to what the VPA was putting forward and Salter themselves at the time, Darabin had a plan where they essentially kept the footprint of the market while building 1,200 dwellings around the market.
Mm-hmm.
So the market as it is, the physical kind of nature of the market is protected. And there's various things within the planning amendment that kind of like talk about the need to sort of retain character and the cultural heritage. And so I think it's mostly protected, but it's also a question of like, what is the market in the future? Because talking about like a bunch of new people coming in and like, how does that change things? Is gentrification a way in which development does eventually happen to Preston Market? And so I think it's like, it's thinking also about the long-term implications of these changes too. But pretty much it's protected, which is good.
That's good news. And Kim, did you want to add anything in there?
I just think it was just an incredible fight for the community. I'm just thinking about that now. I think sometimes the group, we still think about what's been achieved and it still hasn't really sunk in because we're still kind of on edge. We don't know what the future holds, and sometimes there's still a bit of uncertainty even though there is that protected footprint.
Yes.
you know, what will it look like around the market? What will the car park look like? Will that be redeveloped? Yes. And there's questions around that.
There's generally a lot of distrust that's built up over the years because of all the stuff that's like all the different plans to redevelop Preston Market. And so we've had to fight a lot. And so it's very hard for us to trust that everything will be okay, I think.
Yeah. You always sort of remain a little bit on edge. I mean, understandably so, when you walk into the market, like the music, the people, the food, the atmosphere, every time I walk in there, I just think to myself, how can you want to get rid of this? Like, anyway.
I do want to ask something about the sort of new stall holders coming in and, you know, the notion of the character of the market as well, because, yeah, I kind of wonder what is the opportunity for folks, you know, like generational stall holders from a whole range of diverse communities who were pushed out of the market. Like, what's the scope for them to be able to come back?
That's a really good question, because there was a lot of people that actually did close their stalls because of the uncertainty. You know, some people didn't have, I think, ongoing leases. Mm. And so people had to make a choice about leaving. And so there is a stall that, there were a number of stalls that did leave because of that reason. I don't know if people are going to come back. I'm not sure. Mm. It's hard to open a business and then sustain it. And, you know, yeah.
Yeah, makes it tricky for sure. Yeah. And Kim, you're covering the campaign in a documentary that you're making called The People's Market. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us a little bit about what it's been like working with the community on this documentary and what the market means to the community?
Well, I'm a local resident as well, so I actually found out about the campaign from Zeng. he was outside the stall outside Preston Market with a number of other volunteers, and I was also shocked. I couldn't believe that the market had been approved to be knocked down, 80% of the market. Mm. And I used to go to the market as well when I was a young person. I went to Northcote High back in the late 90s, early 2000s. But then I would now go there with my daughter. And I really use that place as a place of social connection as well. And there's so much beautiful cultural exchange that occurs in that place and so much sense of belonging. No matter where you come from, what background you come from, we all are together with each other. And so, back to the question, because I got distracted at Preston Market.
That was the perfect place to sit.
Preston Market has a really special place in so many people's lives. It's the centre of so many people's life. People want to live near Preston Market. And so following that, the story, I wasn't planning on making a feature length. It was meant to be a 20 to 30 minute short documentary just for our community. But I did a version of that and it just didn't work because it just didn't cover the story. Mm. So this documentary is 4 years of a decade-long campaign. So it's only one chapter, but a really important chapter, and follows the journeys of several of the volunteers, including Zeng, he's in it. his personal connection to about his personal connection to Preston Market and everyone's personal connections. And what I really love about this group is it's a really unique bunch. Like, everyone is from all different walks of life, different ages, different lived experiences, different cultural backgrounds, and have come together for one shared cause. And some people in the group had never done anything like this before in their life and were like, oh, wait a minute, no, I need to do something. Mm-hmm. And so I found that the most interesting part about this campaign is like, what makes people want to put their hand up and say, oh, I want to do something? Yeah. And, you know, what's really special is that we didn't know what was going to happen. But, you know, I think it's really beautiful what's happened. Really, it doesn't often happen where people's voices are heard, especially a diverse community which represents a lot of migrant communities. Mm-hmm. And so it was actually listened to and heard and actually something changed. And that's pretty incredible. It's not, sadly not very common, right?
What was the emotion like when you heard, you're like, oh, it's got a heritage, like protection overlay. Like, what? How did you feel?
I think none of us, I don't know about you, but it hasn't really sunk in sometimes for me. I feel like I'm still on edge.
Yeah. I remember riding with my partner at the time when we, like, her parents had come over and taken care of our kids and we went for a ride and I heard the news and I just, like, pulled over and I, like, cried because it was just, like, it was such a big thing. Like, and just, like, all this emotional weight on your shoulders to, like, do the work. Is it going to happen? Is it going to happen? And then it happens. You're like, oh, you can actually just like have a moment of relief. And it was quite nice, but it was still a bit like cool, but also give us the detail of what's going to happen. Mm. Yeah.
Yeah. And where are you up to with the documentary at the moment, Kim? And how can people support it?
Well, so principal filming is complete, and I've been doing that for over 4 years by myself mostly, but I've had some in-kind support, which has been wonderful, from a few local cinematographers, including Alana Thompson from Cinedad Media, and I've got a now producer who's helping me get some funding to get through post-production. So basically that's where I'm at right now, moving to post-production. It's a pretty expensive venture, that part. I've done it so far without any resources except for my own, so and volunteers, which is wonderful. And the support of, say, the Preston Market Action Group, of course.
Of course.
So basically now I'm doing a crowdfunder through Australian Cultural Fund to raise some of the funds to pay an editor, you know, the colour, the sound mixer, colour grader, and all those other costs that are involved at the moment. So people can follow along on Instagram at the People's Market Film and follow along. So hopefully, I don't know when it's film finished yet, but it'll be done at least at the latest mid-year next year.
Good things take time. Good things take time.
Yeah, exactly. And I hope that, we can all celebrate when we watch it, what our community achieved, yeah.
And I did notice on the Save the Preston Market campaign that there are attempts to rename the Reservoir Library.
Yes.
Can you tell us a little bit about that as we wrap up?
Yeah. So for us, Gaetano Greco, who passed away not too long ago. He was a really important part of the Save the Preston Market Action Group. One of the few figures who was there through pretty much from the beginning, and he was our connection to council, and he was a mentor to us. And I think we've been grappling with that loss for a while. And I think for us, we really want to, do something that sort of pays respect to his influence and contribution to the community. And we think that this is a way to do it. And so a few of us have gathered together, including the Save the Preston Market Action Group, to push to rename the Reservoir Library in some way or form with Gaetano Greco's name in there. There'll be a council motion, I think, on the 25th of August. So if everyone jumps on our Instagram, they'll be able to see all the details and information. But the key thing at the moment is to email all the councillors, all the Darebin City councillors, to say, hey, Gaetano, you know, what does Gaetano mean to you? Why is it important to rename the library under his name? And just let them know what he means, I think, is kind of, that's our next sort of focus at the moment, is to, pay respect to Gaetano in that way.
It's beautiful, beautiful. Well, thank you so much, Kim and Zeng, for being on the show. It's been a delight having you in studio.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for having us. It's been so fun.
Yeah. It's good to be here.
Also, if you want a tour of the studio, we can do that.
Yeah, definitely.
Sorry, listeners. Back over to you. That was Zeng Chin, who is a community organizer and has done a PhD on the Save the Preston Market campaign, which the Save the Preston Market group managed to save from development, and Kim Chow Evans, who is making a wonderful documentary about the campaign called The People's Market, and we will have links to all of the wonderful actions that we have spoken about today for the Preston Market up on the show notes.
And also, if you do want to tour the station, we do run station tours at 3CR, so you can write to our projects coordinator, Juliet Fox, at projects@3cr.org.au for a tour of the station. Vale, Gaetano, and we will be back to you shortly with a rundown of what we've covered today.
Don't have $1 million and still want to have a good education for your kid? Tune into the Dogs program. We are the defenders of government schools. 12 p.m. on Saturdays here on 3CR. 855 on the AM dial, podcast streaming live on 3cr.org.au and 3CR digital. We defend government schools because they need it.
You're listening to Thursday Morning Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM, and we are coming up to the end of our program today, and we'll just take you through a quick rundown of what we've covered on the show. So first up, Kate and I spoke a little bit about renting and about rental protections and inspections in particular, and that led into a conversation with Christy Hoskins, who is a Bendigo renter and housing advocate campaigning to strengthen the rights of tenants during routine rental inspections, including by putting restrictions on photography in tenants' homes. We were then joined by Dr. Josh Pallas at Climate Defenders Australia about New South Wales police dropping all remaining charges against arrestees of Rising Tides People's Blockade Action. We then heard from a speech made by journalist Wendy Bacon at a Sydney rally held by healthcare workers in solidarity with Palestine outside New South Wales Opera HQ on the 26th of July. And finally, as you just heard, we were joined by Zeng Chin, activist scholar, co-founder of the Alliance for Praxis Research and member of the Save the Preston Market Action Group, and Kim Chow Evans, who is a creative arts therapist and filmmaker. And they spoke about a documentary underway that has captured the fight to save the Preston Market and also about the new campaign to rename the Reservoir Library. We'll catch you next week.
3CR Breakfast would like to thank the New International Bookshop, Melbourne's radical bookstore and venue, for their financial support of this program. You can find Nibs opposite reception in the Lygon Street wing of Trades Hall Carlton. You can buy books online and keep up to date with upcoming events at nibs.org.au.